Ba 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 ba. Now, Matt, as you can see, I gave a pretty straight rendition there because this, I gotta say, it was a pretty straightforward episode.
Well, let me first also say, welcome to Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. I'm your host, Captain Matt Ross, and I'm here with my XO and number one, Michael Pontone. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Number one to my Captain Matt Ross, feeling pretty good. Not a bad episode. Happy to be talking Star Trek. Happy to slough off the ruin of my everyday life, except, of course, my dog and wife. I mean, my wife and dog. How bad? How dare I?
Well, you notice I also didn't interrupt your terrible singing. But I mean, you know, it's a very nice singing. It's this actually, we're now going to be covering a episode 13, Balance of Terror. To me, it's one of the best episodes ever of the original series. It's actually an homage to The Enemy Below, a submarine chase story, which this kind of is in space. It's actually, I think...
Submarines in space.
That's what they are. That's the way starships in Star Trek are. Big lumbering ships that go through wide angle turns. It's kind of almost like the Age of Sail ships. That's the way starships are shown in Star Trek. Age of Sail, lumbering, slow maneuvers. Also more like World War II. But this is a great episode. It's actually one of my all-time favorites out of all Star Trek. I can watch it hours and hours on end on a loop almost. I find all the characterizations and great depth. What did you think overall on this?
So I was thinking Master and Commander, obviously. I do love 19th century warship stuff. Let me just give the quick synopsis that I'm just pulling online. While investigating the destruction of four outposts along the neutral zone, the Enterprise plays a game of cat and mouse with a Romulan warbird. Classic setup, introduction of the Romulans. Listen, I'm going to be honest with you, Matt. I liked it. It wasn't my favorite. And here's the thing. I like Trek. All my favorite Trek has a pretty heavy dose of sci-fi in the story. So let me explain. Like, I'm not a huge fan of, like, disaster, right? I am a huge fan of cause and effect. Because... one is
not the episode.
Yeah, the episode. the deja vu one, because I like the idea of, like, okay, they're stuck in a time thing as opposed to it's the Poseidon Adventure or Towering Inferno in space. It was good. I mean, here, let's take it from the top. No.
I wanted to read the TV guide version of what you just read as well.
Go for it.
It goes. After a century of peace, the warlike Romulans have sent a powerful flagship to probe the Earth's defenses. With three outposts already destroyed, Kirk knows that that retreat will only invite further devastation. His alternative, counterattack. This week's episode of Star Trek. You also should mention that this is written by a man named Paul Schneider. He is actually credited, Robert Justman and... mentions it in our Bible, the TOS book, These Are the Voyages, Season 1, talking about how he came up with all of the ideas for the Romulans and their entire structure. There's a whole bunch of little interesting things on that, which I will touch upon. But I'm going to tell you this right now, even though we're at the beginning. To me, this is a 10, this episode. I'm telling you right now. You could save your rating for later. But to me, this is a perfect Star Trek episode because it blends humanistic pieces together. It has a really good story. It has an adventure. And it actually shows, to me, the characters that are working well together. But taking it from the top, Mike, you go ahead. What would you like to say?
Okay, let's take it from the top. Okay, I dig that we're starting with the wedding. It's very cool. It kind of sets the tone for the entire show because it is saying, like, hey, this is a Navy ship, just like 1,000 Navy ships for 1,000 years, where there's a captain who is a multi-purpose leader. He's going to marry you, and then the next day, he might send you off to death. I like the conceit of the Romulans popping up and them being fascinated by the cloaking device. I love the look of the Romulan warbird. I don't know why the bird of prey. I don't know why they changed the look of it in TNG. I think it's a really cool kind of like sleek, dark shadow of the Enterprise, where the Enterprise is like, honestly, a little bit awkward looking because it's not supposed to be a warship. This is like a sleek, like a dagger through space. And I really like the painting of the bird underneath, you know, evokes the Romulus and Remus Roman legion look, you know, of the eagle. So all that stuff I loved.
But, you know, it was good. You know, I agree with you on everything you're saying. I mean, there were contrasts. Again, this was designed by that production designer, Hua Chang. He came up with the Romulan warbird, as well as the various design elements for many of the things like the phaser communicator tricorder. So the warbird is really interesting to look at. It is kind of a contrast between the Earth ship or the Federation ship, Starfleet, with its long nacelles. Although one can make a debate that the Enterprise is perfect in its design if you look at it head on for camera work and otherwise. I do like the fact that the warbird does seem to sleekly moving along, slicing through space. But that's the idea, because submarines were originally narrow because they were on diesel engines and they had to slice through the water when they were on top. So it's got a very similar idea. And in fact, it was designed to be a submarine to look that way. Down to the bridge, Matt Jeffries wanted to make the bridge on the Romulan warbird cramped. But I want to point out something from the top. Last episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies, I said that was the end of Yeoman Rand, but we see Yeoman Rand here. Why is that? Well, I'll tell you why. This was the third episode of Star Trek ever filmed. So, of course, she was in it. It's a little weird, but it was the 13th one ever shown on TV.
Yeah,
it's a little odd placement, but this is...
Doesn't make any sense with the scope of the writing and the trajectory. I don't know what the hell they were smoking, because you go from the nonsense, the confused, muddled nonsense of Miri, and then... That's further along than this in terms of the writing?
Well, there's a reason. There's a reason. This had a lot of optical effects between phasers firing. Now, we're seeing the remastered version. But even if you see the original version with the phaser blasts, which are proximity blasts, later named photon torpedoes, the designs cost a lot of money in the 60s to make the designs of the ship, the exteriors of the ships. You had a lot of things going on there. So it took a long time to composite that, to put onto the film, not video, to put it on there. So the only other episode at this time that cost more and took more time in special effects was the Corbomite maneuver because of the large Fisarius. So this has a lot of optical effects between the warbird firing, that torpedo that they fire, the Enterprise firing its phasers, and all the exterior shots of them flying around and disappearing, the warbird turning on its cloaking device. Like I said, by the way, this is based off on The Enemy Below, which stars Robert Mitchum, right? If you haven't seen that yet, and Mike, if you haven't seen it, it's available for YouTube for free. Take a look. It's very jingoistic, pro-USA at first, but if you take a watch the story, you get the same thing you get here, which is the sides of two captains and their crews, each doing their duty. It's an interesting contrast between our hero, Captain Kirk, and our unnamed Romulan commander on the other side. Did you like that Romulan commander? You realized
yes,
who
Mark
it was,
Leonard,
didn't
of course.
You?
Oh, God. I feel bad that I'm going to... This seems like maybe the first time that we're really going to disagree. I really did not like what Mark Leonard was doing here. I didn't like it.
This is his favorite role. He said this is his favorite role. I actually liked Mark Leonard.
I love Mark Leonard as Spock's father, Savick. I know.
Spoilers.
But no, here's my problem with him. Listen, I grew up with TNG, DS9, Romulans, okay? Romulans are snide, sneaky. you know, the opposite of Vulcans. They have, as Worf says, they have no honor. And you know what? They're not even like fun like the Cardassians, because Cardassians will stab you in the back while pouring you a drink. The Romulans will stab you in the back while pissing at you, pissing on you. Like, they're not fun. They're not fun people to hang around with. And Mark Leonard is playing him as so mopey and melodramatic and like introspective and like depressed. He's like an emo captain.
Well, isn't he like Captain Pike? He's the counterpoint to Kirk. You're talking about someone who's tired of war. You know, in The Enemy Below, German captain of the submarine, he's tired of it as well, but he is pushed forward by his mission to, by the way, always turn to the same direction to meet up with a task force that, just like the Romulans, always turning to the same direction to go where they're to go to where they're going. So this is literally the same characters, but with a space theme. There are a lot of differences, too. I will give you that much. I thought Mark Leonard played his character brilliantly. This is the first appearance of the Romulans, and you're doing hindsight 2020 looking at, well, I know what the TNG Romulans are. I mean, you could also say one of the Romulans in the episode The Neutral Zone is played by Mark Alimo, who plays Gul Dukat.
I know.
So what does he know of Romulans?
I got other stuff.
By the way,
keep going.
Well, Mark Leonard, he is actually a rarity in Trek. He's played three characters or three specific types of characters. Can you name all three of them? You know two.
Oh, God.
And one of them was on our community page on YouTube for those of you smart enough to look at and good enough to look at it. Please take a vote if you know who it is. But obviously, I'm giving you a big hint. So he played the Romulan commander. Obviously, he's Spock's father.
I don't know.
And Mike, you have any idea?
I'm not going to get it. I'm sorry. No, I'm not going to.
He's the Klingon captain in the motion picture, the first one you see.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah, so he at one point was one of the only actors that played the three different types of races. An interesting design on the Romulans, because they have the pointed ears like Spock. Before we know about...
Yeah, wait, hold on. I got stuff to say there.
Oh,
keep going.
Go ahead.
I want to make a point.
Okay, I was going to say that... It was a cost-conscious issue over here. They only had enough ears to make Spock, the Romulan commander, and his Centaurian. That's why the Romulans are all wearing helmets.
Those
they were trying
helmets.
To save cash.
Interesting.
By the way, those helmets in real life were uncomfortable. And in a book called The Romulan Way, they're also called uncomfortable as well, where the Romulans are called the Rihansu. So look up the Romulan Way, people. But anyway, you go ahead.
Thank you. Here's the problem, again, that I have in this episode. It's missing a scene, Matt.
Oh.
It's missing a writing scene. There's, at no point does anyone say, hey, they look just like you, Vulcans. And there's at no point a reveal where Spock would say, yes, we are actually related. They were a martial, warlike version of us from thousands of years ago. They split off and started their own empire. They just, it's the same goddamn problem with Miri, where there's just a second Earth that no one comments and there's no explanation. In this, there's a warlike race that looks exactly like the Vulcans, which I think Spock might say one word briefly about.
But you're missing the whole thing. Of course, you need to have everything spoon-fed to you.
No, they don't. They don't say it. At no point is anyone shocked. Matt, they've never seen Romulans before, right? They see Romulans for the first time. They look exactly like their ally, like the first officer. I know the guy is like, oh, hey, we should look at Spock. Maybe he's a traitor. But at no point is anyone like, hey, that in all the billions of alien races, these guys look exactly the like. Spock, what's up with that?
Well, interesting you point out. Paul Connie, who plays Mr. Stiles, which expresses that type of hatred, as we could see in the dialogue.
I was suggesting that Mr. Spock could probably translate it for you, sir.
I assume you're complimenting Mr. Spock on his ability to decode.
I'm not sure, sir.
Well, here's one thing you can be sure of, Mr. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. Do I make myself clear?
You do, sir.
You don't have to say it. He looks directly at Spock, and he makes a snide comment. And there's that Shock on the bridge. Everyone stares directly at Spock once he is able to break through and realize it the same. And you have one of those classic raised eyebrow looks of Leonard Nimoy or Spock raising his eyebrows going, "Oh." And they do mention it in the conference room. Spock says, "I do believe they could be an offshoot of my Vulcan heritage."
"We know what they look like. Yes, indeed we do, Mr. Stiles. And if the Romulans are an offshoot of my Vulcan blood, and I think this likely, then attack becomes even more imperative."
"War is never imperative, Mr. Spock."
"It is for them, Doctor. Vulcan, like Earth, had its aggressive, colonizing period. Savage, even by Earth standards. And if the Romulans retain this martial philosophy, then weakness is something we dare not show."
It could be, you know, the Vulcans are very private. They've alluded to that before in the past with the Vulcan mind meld, how things are very private. They're very alien. They're not going to be chatting about their failures or the people that are in there. So there are some reasons for that. But in this episode, it gives way to the racism in our perfect post-apocalyptic world of Star Trek and a utopia. The old hatreds still exist. And that was what was shown here. By the way, another naval show, a movie like this that also has touches of this, is called The Bedford Incident, starring Sidney Poitier. You should also check that one out. Yes, I do like war movies. This is essentially a war movie, and this was one of the more exciting ones to me. They had a whole bunch of things. This is like a huge episode for all of Star Trek that's echoed for years and years, whether it's in the J.J. Universe movies, which doesn't handle it well, to that show called Discovery, or Picard even. The Romulans do play a central part. In fact, they were supposed to be in Star Trek 3, but everyone thought Klingons would be cooler. That's why the Klingons have a bird of prey, because that was actually supposed to be an updated Romulan bird of prey.
Okay, this leads me right into it, okay?
Go ahead.
Tell me, Matt, because, you know, I look to you for all my lore, and I love chatting with you because, you know, I'm half talking about the episode and half just trying to squeeze someone who knows a lot. What is the official explanation as to why the Romulans and Klingons developed similar technology? They both have cloaking devices, and they both have birds of prey.
Well, you'll actually have to come to a later episode for that. You'll find out that there's actually an exchange of technology between the Romulans and Klingons. The Romulans and Klingons in the lore, realizing they just can't compete with the United Federation of Planets, a.k.a. the United States, form an alliance. It's basically Russia and China that have combined together. And what they're doing is they're trading technology. They don't get along with each other. In fact, they hate each other. But they do trade technology with each other. And then if you watch Discovery, you say, that doesn't make sense. The Discovery timeline doesn't fit at all. Exactly. So this over here, this is before the Klingons have gotten their cloaking technology. You will find that out in a later episode, but we'll come to that when we come to it. In this episode, though, you get the information of the Earth-Romulan War.
Ship-to-ship visual communication. Therefore, no human, Romulan, or ally has ever seen the other. Earth believes the Romulans to be warlike, cruel, treacherous. And only the Romulans know what they think of Earth.
Which has never really been described. Last time I had mentioned a book called Starfleet Year One by Michael Jen, I think it's Friedman. You should check a look at that one as well. A lot of homework assignments for you tonight, Mike, and I expect an essay by Friday, okay, which is,
yes,
from
master,
our timeline tomorrow. But this is, I thought, a very tightly shot story with, again, one of our returning directors, Vincent McIvedy. He did a great job on this. I just like the way they have all the lighting done and the tension that's built up. You get
the
that
lighting is great. I love the whole running silent thing, and I really like the using the phaser, which obviously is supposed to be photon torpedoes, as like depth charges.
Exactly.
In fact, I always, we've talked about this before because I'm a huge aficionado of Undiscovered Country, and I've picked that movie apart, especially the final Navy scene, which I consider to be probably the best in all of Star Trek, when Chang's cloaked experimental Klingon bird of prey is able to fire torpedoes. And I always thought that when the Excelsior arrived, it should have had some sort of firing solution that Sulu remembered from this time, where they, you know, fire out a bunch of different phasers in broad spectrum, which at least gets the bird of prey to hesitate, which is, you know, at least it could have done something other than just take a hit for Enterprise. But anyway, that's just wishful thinking. Going back to a 32-year-old movie and saying, hey, wouldn't it have been cool if they did this instead?
Oh, wow, and I will say, 32 years.
I know, at least. I loved that. It was a really, really cool scene. I will give it props, Matt. When it shot the photon torpedo and they were trying to get away from it as fast as possible.
Yeah, the plasma torpedo. Tension. Yeah, that's like he's like, here's a, put this in the marker boy and launch. And they're counting backwards, going 10 seconds, 9, 8. That was great. But we first see that torpedo when it blows up the Earth listening post. They blew up 3, 8, and the one that they're at right now, where you see the end of Commander Hansen, played by a man named Gary Wahlberg. I found that entire thing, like, that was extremely tense. Like, we've lost everything, and I'm in below 5 miles of iron. And look, it broke our shields. It destroyed everything. That one moment, you could even see it on the actors' faces on the bridge. They emote like we're in deep crap because we can't handle that. And then when they have that torpedo coming at them, they're all freaking out. That's actually pretty wild. Yeah, I agree with you. That is one of the better tense scenes.
Yeoman Rand gets right up in his personal space.
Well, remember, at this point, they're trying to make them a romantic couple. That was the original idea, but I'm glad that they didn't. So that's pretty interesting that you noticed that. And they did have like the kind of like the softer lighting around her and him with like the bands of darkness by his eyes as he's staring at the screen. I love that. I thought it was very tense and very, very cool. But you said you didn't like the Romulans from at this point from Leonard. I think he carries it out. A war-weary, tired commander just trying to get home. He's not looking forward to the next war.
A little bit heavy. A little bit too heavy. I did like how Echoes of Future Trek, I loved hearing the word Praetor. I'm like, oh, yeah, Praetor Shinzon, Praetor everything in the future. Nice to see that they're already keeping it going.
They went to Rome. Romulus and Remus, of course, founded Rome in mythic lore. But they didn't change the names. They felt like people could relate to it better. In that book, The Romulan Way, again, they're called the Rahansu. I think it's spelled with an RH in the beginning. That made it relatable in some ways, and you could see that guy Decius, who like sends out a signal saying, look, we blew up the Earth ships. You'll actually see him again later. I'm just gonna tell you, he's in a mock time. He's actually Stahn later, but his
Hold
character
on. You faded out there. Say it again.
I said that the guy who plays Decius, the guy who sends out a signal, that's actually the actor who plays Stahn later in a mock time. That's the one where Spock has his pon farr mating rituals.
So, oh boy,
So that you have a whole
sexy.
Bunch of exciting. This, by the way, story took four rewrites. It was also had taken two by D.F. Black and one last one by Gene Roddenberry, who kind of pretty much rewrote portions of this in every degree. D.C. Fontana, by the way, calls this her favorite episode. DC Fontana has written a lot of stuff. So,
she have to take a gender neutral name because she
not
was
her.
A lady?
No, Gene Roddenberry. No, that was just her nickname. Dorothy something fun. So, but Gene Roddenberry rewrote this so much that Paul Schneider said, about the only thing that I recognize is my name. They gave him credit. Roddenberry did not take credit for rewriting this at all.
This is pretty naval.
Yes, it sure was.
It's surprising for Roddenberry.
Yeah, it is. It was very well done. By the way, the guy who plays Stan and Decius, it's Lawrence Montaguer. He was pretty good. I liked also Paul Connie, the guy who says his racist things. I actually like that scene too, where Kirk goes over to him. Oh, you're complimenting Spock's ability to code, and then that entire little scene, telling him leave your racist beliefs behind. I thought that was pretty well done. What did you think about?
Yeah, I mean, pretty impressive, because that's the thing. Like at the time, you know, this is before political correctness. There were people who were openly racist, and they were like, yeah, man, it's just a point counterpoint. Like, you like the Yankees, I like the Mets. I'm racist, you're not.
I was suggesting that Mr. Spock could probably translate it for you, sir.
I assume you're complimenting Mr. Spock on his ability to decode.
I'm not sure, sir.
Well, here's one thing you can be sure of, mister. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. Do I make myself clear?
You do, sir.
You know, it's not a moral failing. So the fact that they were taking such a strong line on it, being like, hey, man, this is no good. It's, you know, I love media when you take that stand and it's the first time that you see it. And, you know, you see it here. You see it, obviously, with Uhura being a black woman in charge, who's an officer, who's commanding on the ship. And even when I think back, and just, of course, I like to go on my little cinephile tangents. Did you ever see, of course, I mean, we're both lawyers, 12 Angry Men?
Yes, I love that movie.
Love it. And so, you know, when one of them goes on the racist rant and they all turn their back on him, I'm like, that had to be one of the first times in cinema where you were seeing someone reject race. Well, no, what am I saying? Kill a Mockingbird was probably before that. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. It's interesting to track how these political movements kind of bloom through art.
Yes. And this is, again, you know, art imitating life. This was actually really well done. You see the seething hatred in Stiles, who's upset not only because in the Earth Romulan lore he lost his father and several brothers. I also do like the fact that Kirk says their war.
I had no idea that history was your specialty.
Family history. There was a Captain Stiles in the Space Service then. Two commanders, several junior officers. All lost in that war, sir.
Their war, Mr. Stiles.
Not yours.
Right.
To remind him, here we are in today. Focus on today. We're beyond that. So the Federation, which is still, again, not named, is not exactly perfect as you'd want it to be. In these episodes, you get the idea that we bring our problems with us into space. And you have a more martial Starfleet at this time. And if you look at the later Star Treks, specifically Enterprise, and this is one of the issues I have with the episodes of Enterprise, they are not martial. And it doesn't make much sense.
How did they portray the Romulans?
Well, the Romulans, they shouldn't have met the Romulans in Enterprise towards the end. There was a debate to make that Starfleet Year One as the TV show, but of course Paramount, led by Les Moonves, said no. In fact, he wanted to put boy bands on the ship. But the way they meet the Romulans in Enterprise is they first meet them in an episode called Minefield, where they run into a minefield and there's a cloaking device that they have, which doesn't make sense since this is the first appearance of the cloaking device.
And do they just not call them Romulans? Do they not know who they are?
They know. They get to know them as Romulans. In fact, there's another couple episodes. Yeah, it doesn't fit. There's a joke that Enterprise has been breaking canon for years. So,
well, you know what? The good thing about Enterprise, though, you can always blame it on the temporal Cold War.
Oh, God, please. But, you know, it's also, I think part of the problem is I still think Scott Bakula, who's Captain Archer, and that was miscast because he's too much of a gee whiz, let's go do something, kind of playing Samuel Beckett. Not that he's a bad actor, but the way they portrayed him or the way he portrayed the captain, I believe, was incorrect. There are a lot of nice things in Enterprise. The first season I like, the fourth season I like, the Zindi War I don't like, and the second season is kind of boring. But the thing that Enterprise forgets, and a lot of people forget, You're coming off of World War III and the Eugenics War. You had biological weapons. You had destruction of Earth. And now we have Earth coming on its own in TOS, the way you see it. Of course they're going to be martial. Of course we're going to be having weapons in space. Enterprise takes that all out. But getting back to this, if you didn't know about Enterprise, of course you would have ships with weaponry out there. Because you're slightly paranoid about everyone out there. You would want to have your ships armed. I mean, you could say that maybe, you know, humanity in its growing up phase decided, you know what, we'll go out there and unarm ships and everyone will be nice. But that's kind of naive. I think in the post-apocalyptic vision of this new utopia, there's always something in the back of one's head saying like, yeah, we'll go out nicely, but let's carry a big stick with us. You know, walk softly, carry a big stick. But that's, I loved it. Did you like the actor who played Stiles, Paul Connie?
Yeah, fine. I mean, I don't know, nothing to write home about. It reminded me of something I liked a lot more.
Yeah?
The Wounded, TNG.
Oh, yes. You're talking about the captain who was in the Shawshank Redemption and...
Yes, Bob Gunton, great actor.
Yes, great actor. Very similar,
but also interesting flip side where, you know, you expect him, he's going around, he's murdering Cardassians, you know, he's blowing up ships, he's rogue, he's not taking orders from his admiral, and then you see him, and he's a nice guy. He's like, hey, hi, everyone. And he's like, oh, Miles, so nice to see you again. And when they're like, what's going on? He's like, well, these people are planning on killing us. I found them out, and I've been taking them out one by one. You know, just like the opposite, where it shows like people can have preconceived notions and paranoia, and to them it'll seem as plain as the nose on your face. Like, why wouldn't you be believing me? And then another way to do it is a little bit more outwardly hostile and younger, like Stiles here.
Yep, Stiles. This is the last we ever see of Stiles, but I like that. I like that the counterpoint. And also with Kirk kind of like enforcing discipline, saying, listen, cut your crap. I also like that meeting where they actually take out the strongest metal of the Federation or the unnamed Federation, the strongest metal that Starfleet has, and Spock like just crushes it.
This is the hardest substance known to our science. Lab theorizes an enveloping energy plasma. Forcing an implosion.
It gets hit with a plasma torpedo. That's a kind of scary weapon, like, geez. But that's where they come up with their plan to use a comet to, like, track them. If they go through it, they'll realize that they can see their shadow running through it. And that's where they come up with their plan to hunt down the Romulan warbird. What, to me, you were mentioning Uhura. This is actually, I think, one of the best scenes where she shines in a way. Is that Kirk calls the bridge. She's in command of the ship, as you were pointing out.
Yes.
And it's that's actually really awesome that you have a crew of, it's not just one race or group, it's a multicultural group up there, and they're all top of their game. And they don't wear anything other than the fact that we're all one unit on their sleeves.
Right.
And that's the best part of this. They don't advertise, oh, I'm this, I'm that. We're all part of the same group, and we're going to work as a team. And that really comes across on this. Even with Lieutenant Stiles acting like a racist prick, it is actually, and even he acts as part of the team as well. It's not like he said, I ain't working with Spock. I think he was just shocked, considering he had a personal connection in this. Did you have any comment on that conference room scene?
No, I mean, it's just that here's my problem with this. Mm-hmm. The movie was kind of, the show was kind of very similar. Its first act was very similar to its second act, was similar to its third act. Do you know what I mean? And it's like nothing too much happens. Again, it's a nice, tense war thriller. But it's not like, there's no big aha reveal. You know what I mean?
Well,
breakthrough or use of science.
No, this is a war movie. This is 100% a war movie.
Go on. Sorry.
No, I was just saying you learn things too. You learn about that split between the Vulcans and the Romulans, kind of. You learn that there was some fierce war that was Very brutal and atomic, as Spock actually says. You also learn that the entire crew and the outposts are expendable to avoid war, which makes you wonder how brutal was that war. There's lots of apocrypha. There's no real discussion of it in actual lore. You can use Memory Alpha or Beta, fans of yelling at gaseous anomalies, to look it up or read the books that are out there. But it kind of adds to a sort of mysteriousness and yet somewhat familiarity for when this story was portrayed. You have Vietnam, so you can make this North Vietnam versus South Vietnam with the support of the United States, which is a proxy for the United States and Russia. And also you could take a look at it as North Korea versus South Korea. So to an audience in the 60s or even now, it does have that feel of a war film. I don't think it needs to add anything else. I also like the fact that you have the stress of command on William Shatner, on Captain Kirk, in this. I think he actually plays that very well in some of his best acting. I think it's better done here than in the Corbomite maneuver, where he loses it and comes up with bluffing. This one, he's freaked out in a way because he doesn't know if they're going to live or die.
I see the men waiting for me to make the next move. And Bones, what if I'm wrong?
Which is then shown by Mark Leonard on the other end having a very similar conversation with his conscience. There is the Centurion, here on the Enterprise is Dr. McCoy. So did you catch also, by the way, about the connection between Kirk and McCoy and Pike and Dr. Piper?
No. Sorry,
no?
I missed
it. Okay. In the Menagerie, well, you'll see it more when we do the cage properly. In the Menagerie, which was actually shown in the part one, there's a scene where Pike says to Piper, I'm tired of all this, and I'm worried, and I'm tired of deciding who lives and who dies, and Piper as his conscience.
Yes, I do remember that.
They were trying to do the same thing with McCoy and Kirk, and I think they kind of nail it right here. So there you go. By the way, when this aired, McCoy was like, well, that's the end of my contract. I don't know what's going to happen. And his wife said, we have just enough money to pay the mortgage for a year. Lo and behold, I think they made it for the rest of their lives.
Hey, God bless him. Maybe that's why he was so nice to the fans. He was supposed to be pretty good to the fans, right?
He really was. I met him. He was very frail when I met him in like the 80s and 90s. But he was always very affable, friendly, to a fault, which was always very nice. By the way, Strange New Worlds, the newer Star Trek, redoes this episode almost scene by scene. It's called The Quality of Mercy. Everyone says, oh, it's just like, and that's a problem I have with Strange New Worlds. It's just like this. It's a problem with a lot of new Trek. They take all the existing better writing and they make this.
I know. But, well, I mean, it's the problem with, listen, it's why when you're updating things now, it's like, do you go the safe route? And this is what it is. It's a writer. They're up late. They're under a deadline. They don't have any life experience, and they're like, well, listen, if I could just take the original script and tweak a few things and slap a fresh coat of paint on it, I've just got it done. It'll be good enough, and the producers will like it, and we're pretty sure the fans will like it too because it's similar to something they've seen. It's the same crap that occurred with Force Awakens, which set the tone for a creatively bankrupt sequel trilogy that everyone's forgotten, that no one gives a crap about, way less than the horrible prequels.
It's terrible.
Because at least the prequels were... Here's the thing about the prequels. At least they brought something new to the table that you've not seen before. It was trash, but at least it was different. This was just trash that you've already seen. Anyway, I digress. In terms of remakes, you're not a horror guy, right?
No, not particularly.
Well, did you ever hear of a 70s Italian movie called Suspiria?
Oh, of course. I love that movie. I own
really?
It. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah,
well, there's
also one. There's also a space version of the same thing. It's pretty funny.
What?
Yeah, no, I'm serious. I have to find the name of that one, but
please do.
It's pretty bizarre.
There's the remake of Suspiria rocks. It is so good. I loved it. And it's essentially arguably the same story, except completely different. They've gone completely different in a completely different creative direction while having the same kind of like elevator pitch of the movie, right?
Right.
So
right.
give it a look if you ever can. And it just shows you, like, you know, you can make new things and also bring your own creative flair and choice to it, which, I don't know. I guess there we are. There's not that much to say about the episode. That's another thing. It's like, you know, it goes on. It's a nice thriller. It's got some good visual effects, and then it ends.
Well, it's worth a lot to me, in that the story shows the humanistic qualities of everyone. They're all working together. They're not. It's again a war story. It's a lot of fun. It has a lot of great tension in it. The interesting things that they did to make it like the submarine, like we said, with the firing of the torpedoes or depth charges. The plasma torpedo is a torpedo back. The thing to make it feel like a ship, where the Enterprise is a chasing destroyer, is the way they had the command to fire, like would happen actually in real life at that time. The captain tells the weapons officer. The weapons officer contacts the phaser crew, and then the phaser crew fires. But boy, if you look at it that way, are those phasers over-engineered? Think about all the problems that they had. They've got the control points on the bridge. You got a crew of like 10 down there below, and the guy on top, plus buttons. And later we see like that leak, the coolant leak with the pink stuff. By the actor who was down there, his son said, "How come Spock could save Stiles but not you?" Because I don't know, but he said he was coughing up pink crap for like days afterwards.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
I was about to say, I don't even want to know what that day on the set was like. Like, all right, it's 1966. You're a third-rate actor. You got some lines. You're getting paid $50. Inhale this bright purple smoke that we're going to shoot into your face.
Like, yeah, I know, right? Well, by the way, this is one of the most expensive ones at the time.
I can believe that.
It was $236,000 at the time in 1966. That would be an episode today of $2,277,926.66, which kind of matches the year. But between the Romulan Warbird, that special effect with the torpedo, I love every last little bit of this. And when I watch this, I feel like I'm there. I feel like I can feel the tension. I like the way the captain talks to the crew about how they're all concerned. Will they get out of it? And even at that last ending, you know, and they are of a kind. And in one another world, you and I could have been friends. I always like that last scene when they finally get that Romulan warbird.
I regret that we meet in this way. You and I are of a kind. In a different reality, I could have called your friend.
They trick him. By the way, that's actually a kind of a scene from The Enemy Below, which I'll probably insert the soundbite about here, where they mention almost similar lines about, like, that one's a wizard. He knows my thoughts.
Oh, Commander. How?
He's a sorcerer, that one. He reads the thoughts.
He's a devil, Annie. Somehow we must lose him.
That's pretty much what happens in The Enemy Below, where they're chasing each other, and the U.S. commander kind of guesses at the German U-boat's plan. And then in The Enemy Below, the German U-boat always goes on a course 140, exactly the same coordinates kind of where Romulus is, to head on a specific plan. But I really like this one. I don't know, what else would you like to add to this?
Nothing much. It was, again, let's get to ratings. Honestly, Matt, I know I'm going to break your heart. I'm going to give this a 7.
Ah, Shame on you.
It didn't spark my imagination.
All right, that's fair.
Honestly, that's what Trek, my favorite Trek, does. Even when it's very action centric, like, you know, even like when arguably the more action centric Trek I've liked, like the naval battle in the end of Undiscovered Country, or the Borg battles in First Contact, it was, I don't know, there was something about it that really swept me up. And this one was just like, okay, like you said, it's Navy in space, just like Disaster is Poseidon Adventure in space. It's cool, but I'm just like, meh. And what was your sci-fi conceit?
Well, no, this is not a sci-fi con. The cloaking device is the sci-fi conceit, but you could say that's diving underwater. But if it came down to, I still, like I said, for me, this is a perfect episode. I give this a 10. Maybe I'll make it go to a 9. But
don't lower it on my account. I respect.
I'm not lowering nothing for you, man. But okay. I really like this episode a lot. It actually, for some reason, it's always been one of my favorites out of all Trek. And when I watch it, I go to my happy place. And I like the fact that everyone's competent. I like the characterizations of people. I really like Mark Leonard as the Romulan commander. I just find it all around enjoyable. And so nah. But there you go.
No, not nah. Listen, quick aside, because when I think of my Happy Place episodes, I think of the Thaw Voyager. You know, I think of
Mud's Women.
What?
Mud's Women.
No, not Mud's Women. No, sir. And of course, all of Star Trek Picard season 3.
What about the penis rock from What Are Little Girls Made
No,
Of?
No, not. Not my, can you believe it? Not quite my cup of tea. but let me ask you something. Quick aside, just to round this one off and a little esoterica. What is your, what would you say is your favorite action movie right off the top of your head?
Die Hard.
Interesting. You see, mine is Terminator 2.
Yeah, well, that's so, a sci-fi action movie, but I like that one too.
It is.
I like Die Hard for its pure, you know, yippee-ki-yay, man. I enjoyed it a lot. It's also a Christmas movie at the same time. So.
Yes, it is. I agree with that. Just like Batman Returns. Mm-hmm. If it takes place at Christmas, it's a Christmas movie.
Well, all right. Well, so there we go. We got our scores. You gave it a 7. I'm giving it a 10. And I think we're wrapping it up this time on Yelling at Cassius Anomalies. Mike, is there anything else you want to tell our beloved audience, all dozens of them out there?
Hey, to you dozens, we love you. Keep listening. I don't care if it ever goes any bigger than just this a dozen or so, as long as they love us, because
we
love
you too.
We need
our sponsorship money. Come on.
Oh, yes. In a few years, we might be able to get a brush.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes, the Fillmore brush. Well, you know, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, fans of Yelling at Cassius Anomalies. And remember, you can always reach out to us at yellingatgas@gmail.com, or you can find us on our Facebook page or the numerous podcasters that we're on, and YouTube and everywhere. And we look forward to seeing you on our next episode. Our next episode is actually a fun one called Shore Leave. That's on our next episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies.
Is that the one with the Alice in Wonderland rabbit?
Yes, it is the one with the Alice in Wonderland rabbit. And when there's something really funny, because one of the characters from this episode is prominently displayed in this one. But in the meantime, everyone, listen, live long and prosper, and we'll see you out there. So listen, Mike, you have a good evening, and live long and prosper.
You too. Thank you, Captain.
Both Earth outposts gone. The asteroids they were constructed on, pulverized.